appeal numbers 24-1392, 1393, 1394, 1395, and 1960, Tischhauser versus Mode Transportation LLC et al. Give you time to get settled.
May I ask, what of the counsel for this field is in Europe?
We have counsel remotely on the video.
Okay.
Yes, if you look up there at the screen, you can see him.
Good morning. So,
good morning. You have given us your proposed breakdown of how you want this appeal argued. Mr. Tooney, you're first on behalf of the appellants. You have 6 minutes, and then Mr. Lesbranche, you're on the video here. You go second with 2 minutes. So Mr. Tooney, I'm going to start with you. Whenever you're ready, come up to the podium, please, and we will give you 6 minutes, saving two for rebuttal. So watch your time. Mr. Tooney, are you ready, sir?
Yes, sir.
Come on up to the podium, please.
Don't you recall the case argument? I misunderstood. I'm sorry.
ACE will argue first for the defendants. So I'm following the order that you gave us. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for your patience with me. 40 years ago when I came here, I didn't have Google Maps, and here it didn't help me today either.
And I will note that Mr. Lesbranche is on the phone, on the video, so go ahead, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. As you've seen through the plea or the brief that we filed, we are here to ask the court to reverse itself from the Yee decision. We are aware that there's a high mark that we have to achieve to justify that. I think we have that. The Hively case indicated that adjusting your jurisprudence to be in coordination with what the Supreme Court is saying was the reason justified for the using Hively to change the jurisprudence of this court. We think that same formula works here, in that all of the cases by the Supreme Court dealing with exceptions to making exceptions under the historic police powers of the states to having rights or claims wiped out. None of those cases was discussed in Yee. I think the problem that happened in Yee was citing Puerto Rico, which in one sentence stated that when there is an express preemption clause, the court should look to the language of the statute to interpret it. But there's
Tooney,
also case law.
So we reaffirmed Yee in Montgomery.
Yes.
And declined to revisit it. And I know there's a circuit split right now, and I think you would agree that the Supreme Court has never addressed the precise preemption issue before the court today, and that was before the court in Yee.
They have not addressed it like this, although they've discussed it.
There are two cert petitions pending before the Supreme Court now, one in our Montgomery case and one in the Sixth Circuit's recent decision in Cox, which came out the other way from us in Yee. Is there any reason that this court should hold off deciding your case until we get the guidance from the Supreme Court or see if they're going to take the cases?
I would argue yes, this court should enter its ruling simply because
So wait, yes to my question was a little different. I want to make sure you understand the question. My question for you is, should we wait for the Supreme Court to see if they are going to grant the cert petitions? And if they do, wait to see how they come out? Or should we just decide this case?
I think you should just decide it. I think
Why?
it would be better for this court to correct what I think was a terrible error, rather than have it do it on reversal by the Supreme Court. The decisions of the Supreme Court were never came up in Yee. I think that what happened with that one sentence in Puerto Rico saying that you should simply analyze the language of it, of the statute at issue. Puerto Rico did not discuss and did not even attempt to analyze why it should reverse anything in the jurisprudence concerning the police powers of the state being protected. The police powers of the state were not even were not involved in Puerto Rico, which I imagine is the reason for the way they wrote that decision. But it's not as if the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court had stopped less than 2 years after the last case decided by the Supreme Court, where they used that power to say that the police powers of the state were to be garnered.
If you assume we don't overrule Yee, that there are some distinguishing facts here. You have a shipper that wasn't present in Yee. You have some claims that weren't precisely addressed in Yee. If we don't overrule Yee, where does that leave us on affirming the motion to dismiss?
If you do not overrule, well, I guess then we'll be looking to see what the Supreme Court does on these other cases. They've denied cert so far, I think, five times on this issue. Perhaps the Cox case will be a reason why they finally decide they want to take it.
My question's a little different. I assume Yee remains good law.
I'm sorry?
Assume Yee remains good law, that we don't overturn it, that the Supreme Court doesn't disturb that core holding. Would you still be arguing that under Yee there are some distinguishing factors, such as you have a shipper here as one of the defendants?
Well, you have a shipper, but there's a question about whether or not the trial court's ruling pre preventing a move, an action against the shipper. There's a question about whether that's valid. The shipper could have potential liability through the broker if the broker is li has any liability.
You didn't differentiate between the shipper and the broker in your briefs. Do you agree that their liability rises and falls together? So if Yee applies to the broker, do you agree it also applies to the shipper?
I believe it does ride together.
You're into your did you, you're into your rebuttal time if you want to save the remainder, Mr. Tooney.
No, I'd like to save my rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. L'Esperance, good morning. Can you hear us okay?
I can. Thank you, Your Honor. And I do appreciate Lee granting me remote appearance today. It's an honor to be in front of the court. I'm arguing primarily on the procedural issues here today. And it won't take long, but the primary concern I have here is if you affirm the district court decision, and assuming Yee was upheld and not addressed by the court, then you're effectively overturning your own case law and preemption in relation to when is it appropriate to bring a motion to dismiss. And this issue on preemption comes up about once or twice every decade, it looks like, on the court law, in the case law. And the court has been firm in that you cannot bring a motion, a 12B6 motion on a preemption defense because it has not been pled. And that's what
We
happened here.
also have law that says there's a narrow and pragmatic exception to that. And that's when raising the affirmative defense, you don't need to go through a 12C because it's apparent on the face of the complaint. Why wouldn't this affirmative defense, namely preemption, be apparent from the face of the complaint, especially in light of Yee and Montgomery?
That's a great question, Your Honor. And primarily because that case law deals with statute of limitations. When you look at the cases
but
cited,
it wasn't limited to statute of limitations. It was addressed affirmative defenses.
Yeah, and statute of limitations is an affirmative defense.
As is
and
preemption.
Yes, but statute of limitations are different. You look at a statute of limitation case, the plaintiff should know what the dates are in terms of the incident or occurrence. And you shouldn't have to wait until the defendant anticipates that defense. Whereas when you have preemption, the plaintiff does not know that that defense will be pled. So it's, we can't anticipate it. The case law is very clear. You cannot anticipate the defenses. You're not required to do it. So when you look at a statute of limitations case, the plaintiff should know the dates. And when they assert those dates in the complaint, it is highly credible for the court to rely upon in that regard. Here we have no facts or circumstances from the defense. They have not submitted any evidence in this case on what their case is related to their defense. They've just submitted argument. Briefs are not the pleadings. And so that's a very distinguishing argument. That's why I believe that that case law is limited to statute of limitations cases. But
Mr.
generally
Response,
speaking,
why would it make a difference here? You know, what do you think we would glean from a defendant's pleadings that might, that would bear on this decision beyond what we can see from the complaint?
Well, it does matter in terms of the plaintiff being able to contest the facts and circumstances. Here, the relationships. This case is important in terms of relationships. And so we would be able to conduct discovery to test that and confirm, do they have a broker license? Are they associated with motor carriers and whatnot? You could go into that and start contesting that evidence and say, no, preemption does not exist under XYZ law here, the FAAAAA.
But presumably we could decide it on under the procedural rule that you you advocate, we would be able to decide the issue, would you agree, as soon as an answer is filed?
Well, not necessarily as soon as it, but it does open the door then to, again, pursue discovery, at least request the district court. I guess the district court would have to take that into consideration. I can, you know, my experience, I've never seen a 12C motion brought right after the answer is filed, but theoretically it is possible, but the plaintiff would have alternatives to respond. And unless the court has any other specific questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my argument for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lesperance.
Thank you.
Mr. Wadley? And you are arguing on behalf of ACE, probably.
I am, yes.
Okay.
May it please the court, Chris Wadley on behalf of ACE Property and Casualty Insurance Company. Your Honors, our position in this case is that the district court erred by declining to apply subsection 2 of Wisconsin Statute Section 628.46 and instead holding ACE liable to pay interest on the full amount of Mr. Tischhauser's initial policy limit demand.
Swadley, can I? Go ahead, please.
Subsection 2 talks about not being able to obtain a release. You just wanted a release from every claimant. Isn't that a little different?
Well, subsection 2 talks about not knowing who is entitled to receive the payment. So there's three elements of the portion that we're relying on here. One is the carrier is unable to determine who is entitled to receive the payment. The carrier notifies the claimant of that inability and promises to pay upon resolution or determination of who's entitled. In this situation, all three of those elements are satisfied. We had four claimants, all severely injured in the same accident, three of whom had damages standing alone that exceeded the entire policy limit. So therefore, the carrier in this situation, my client, was unable to determine who was quote unquote entitled to the policy proceeds.
Mr. Wadley, what are we then to make of the correspondence from your clients that basically said that ACE had the right to dispense payment to whichever one of the claimants had provided enough proof of special damages to merit them?
Well, that was certainly the position that my client took based on
and the so case. Your client, and do you agree with that position?
Well, it's an argument based on the Loveland case that the direct action statute does not require a pro rata distribution. I don't know that there's a case that definitively establishes that as a matter of law under Wisconsin law.
I guess my question is a bit more direct than that. Do you agree or disagree with what your client said in that email?
I agree that in that situation, if ACE were to make a determination on itself as to how to allocate the proceeds in the best interest of its insureds, that would be appropriate under the circumstances. But the problem with that is that anytime you have a conflict of interest between an insured and the insurance carrier, where the insurance carrier controls the payment of the money, it could be subject to second guessings, especially if it leaves the insured exposed to additional liability. So you have a situation here where subsection 2 of the statute we think is plainly satisfied, given that there's no statute, there's no case, there's no Wisconsin law that says Mr. Tischhauser was entitled to the full policy limit just because he's the first one that asked.
I think you could have stopped after there's no Wisconsin law, period, on this particular provision.
Right.
There isn't one way or the other.
That's exactly right. The cases that have interpreted this have said, okay, in a single claimant case where there's no question of liability and there's no question that the damages exceed the policy limit, in that case, the carrier cannot say, I'm not going to pay the policy limit unless you give my insured a release. So that's Wisconsin case law on that. But the case law does not interpret subsection 2, which is the situation that we have here, where you have four severely injured claimants, three of whom have damages that exceed the limit standing alone. And there's simply no case, statute, anything that says Mr. Tischhauser is entitled to the full $1 million simply because he demanded it first.
Are you disputing that your client had to pay any interest at all? Or is your argument that it should have paid interest pro rata?
Our argument is that it shouldn't have had to pay interest at all because it...
How did you satisfy the requirement that your client had to offer in good faith to promptly pay said claim upon determination of who is entitled to receive such payment?
So if you look at the correspondence that was issued, and I would refer to document 215-3 in the trial court record, and that's the email in which counsel for ACE and its insureds proposes four different methods by which the parties could agree on an allocation, and there's an offer to pay in there upon a determination. And those four...
The offer is that you're waiting for the releases, not that you're offering to pay.
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think if you look at the emails, counsel is saying, we would like releases as part of this negotiated settlement. But there's not, what we don't have is a situation here where the four claimants said, okay, we agree, this is how the $1 million should be split up. There's no dispute as so entitlement is satisfied, pay that, but we're not going to give your insureds a release. And if that was the situation, and if A said, okay, we've all agreed on how the money should be split up, but we're not gonna pay it unless we get releases for our insureds, then you would be in the conduits area where that would be not a defense to owing interest. But we had a situation here where the claimants would not agree amongst themselves, excuse me, how to divvy up that money. And what ACE is saying is that, okay, well, as part of the process of figuring this out, we would like to get releases. And in fact, if you look at 215-8, I believe the document is, Counsel says, excuse me, I'll find it here. He basically says, look, I'm going to ask for releases. If it's in the cards, I would like releases for my insurance. But nowhere does he say
a little bit stronger than in 215.13. He said, look, there's a $1 million policy. It's already down to about 999,000. And the longer it takes to agree, essentially, you're not going to have it to agree and to complete the releases and hold harmless.
And again, Your Honor, there's nothing wrong with asking for a release as part of this process.
I agree there's nothing wrong with that, and it makes good business sense for your client. But that's not what the language of this is about. This is about paying interest, but you have to make a good faith offer to promptly pay. So two separate issues.
Well, I think we did satisfy that. I think we did satisfy that by the correspondence that said we will pay if there's a determination as to who is entitled to what portion of the proceeds. And there were four different methodologies that were presented as a way to get there. Now, if that had been resolved and they said, we're still not going to pay you until we get releases, that would be an entirely different situation. But unless and until that initial determination of who's entitled to the proceeds, subsection 2 kicks in and interest does not accrue.
But I thought the your client had stated that Mr. Tischhauser has already submitted a written settlement demand, sufficient supporting documentation demanding payment of the remaining available limit. So it's not that the insurer, it's not like your client wasn't able to determine that he was entitled to it. You're saying that your client wasn't able to determine who else might have been entitled to it. But the thing is, at a minimum, your client, Mr. Tischhauser, provided sufficient information. I don't think there's any dispute about that. And that information indicated that he would probably exhaust the remaining limits, available limits. And at that point, it seems as though the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision Kantowitz kind of kicks in. And, you know, we're not talking about whether or not the insurer has to, you know, satisfy some metaphysical certainty as to how everything should work out. I mean, from the language of statute, it seems like, boom, when the insurer knows and is able to determine, which your client claims it was, proceeds should be released.
So that presumes that Mr. Tischhauser was entitled to 100% of the policy limit simply because he made the first demand. And there's not any case law that says just because he's the first one that got a lawyer and issued a demand means he's entitled to 100% of the proceeds. Ace was fully aware of the fact that there were four injured claimants and that they all had suffered severe injuries. So, I mean, if that's the nature of Wisconsin law is that we want to reward the first one to issue one of those demand letters, then I suppose so be it. But that may be a reason to certify the question to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We don't think that that's good public policy. We don't think that's an appropriate resolution because that leaves the other 300 claimants completely without any insurance recovery. It leaves the insured without any insurance proceeds to defend or indemnify with respect to those remaining three claims. So yes, we were aware that a demand had been made. We were aware that Mr. Tischhauser's injuries were sufficient to justify payment of the policy limit. But what distinguishes this case from Contuance is that we had three other claimants that were also injured, two other ones also had injuries that by themselves exceeded the policy limit.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wendley. Mr. Kuzmanovic?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Very pleased the court. I'm here on behalf of Mode. Mode was, Yee was decided in 2023. Montgomery was decided this year. Judge St. Eve, you are well aware, having been on both of those panels, I've heard these arguments before. It's our position that the negligent hiring, negligent selection claim has been properly dismissed because the F4A preempts that.
Mr. Kuzmanovic, could your client ever be liable for negligent hiring? I know there were various theories of liability, joint venture, otherwise here, and you're arguing preemption should apply to all of them. But is there any theory under which your client could be liable?
I have not seen any case that would allow for that in terms of what the facts that have been.
Played. Even the extreme, even if your client hired somebody or was the broker for a company that it knew had the worst drivers with the worst record who had DUIs. I mean, come up with this scenario.
I'm sure theoretically, Judge, that there is a scenario in which somebody could try to pierce that. But at least as far as the facts that have been pled in this case and the facts that we've seen both in Yee and Montgomery, I don't see that in the Seventh Circuit. And I think what we look at here from the standpoint of preemption, in this particular case, we've got the negligent selection. We also have the agency and joint venture claims, which are also negligence claims, which Judge Griesbach also dismissed, and which we agree with, obviously, entirely. Then we've got the alternative methodology that the judge used for failure to state a claim under Iqbal for the other individually pled negligence claims. So in our view, Judge Griesbach properly decided first the negligence claims based on Yee, and I'm looking at the Yee case language at page 459. By recognizing common law negligence claims, courts would impose in the name of state law a new and clear duty of care on brokers. Well, we have that. That's what these other two claims are, the joint venture claim and the agency claim. And if you look at what Judge Griesbach did in analyzing those claims and going through the complaint and looking at whether they were even well pled, even Judge Griesbach found that as an alternative method to getting the case dismissed, those claims were not pled well.
What's your position on whether or not we should wait and see if the Supreme Court grants cert in either Montgomery or the Cox case?
Our position is that the court should not wait. It's good law. It's in this circuit, and there are two cases that have held that the F4A preempts negligence claims against brokers. So it's our position that the court should not wait.
If I could ask, so I take it that the plaintiffs had brought a negligence claim against the driver's employer, Firebird, that claim would likely survive preemption.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think it did, Judge.
And so then if there is alleged some sort of joint venture or agency theory, and I understand you take issue with whether something was sufficiently pled here, but assume that that the plaintiffs could allege that Mode and even Cisco, directly was able to dictate the working environment, the working restrictions, and had someone on site that was supervising Firebird's drivers. In that kind of factual scenario, would you agree with me that a vicarious liability claim or even a joint venture claim might survive preemption because it's basically, I mean, there's nothing to really distinguish that from a direct negligence claim against the employer?
I think, Judge, it all boils down to control, whether that control is adequately pled, number one. And for the joint venture theory, you have to share profit.
No, I understand. But if we assume that for current purposes, that those claims were adequately pled, then you would agree that we have a much closer call.
I think so, Judge. I do agree. But our position is that, A, they weren't properly pled, and B, in this fact scenario, we're so far down the line here. Mode hired Donnelly. And Donnelly subcontracted to someone else who then further had their own driver. So we are way down the stream here.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Temple?
Good morning. May it please the court. James Temple on behalf of Cisco Corporation. And to echo my colleague's comments, we believe that the district court properly dismissed all complaints pending against Cisco under both preemption and 12b6, no plausible claim. We believe that under the analysis of Roe, as well as under the analysis of Yee, preemption was properly applied to bar the tort claims pending against Cisco Corporation. Cisco Corporation is a shipper in this case. Cisco had an agreement, a separate standalone agreement with Mode to broker loads. Mode then would go out and find motor carriers to ship the loads. In this case, that was Donnelly. Donnelly then found another motor carrier who had a driver to ship the load at issue. And as the district court pointed out, the driver never actually got the load to pick up from Cisco. So in this case, from a plausibility standpoint, based upon the allegations in all of the complaints, there is no plausible theory under those allegations by which Cisco could ever be connected to the negligent actions of a driver under the allegations of these complaints, and was promptly dismissed on a 12b6 basis. The joint venture claims, as Judge Lee just pointed out, were not properly pled, although the allegations were incorporated into that count. So you have a count that alleges desperate treatment, does not have a common contract, does not have a common purpose, and does not have sharing of profits to meet the basic elements of a joint venture. So that was properly dismissed on a plausibility basis. Going back to preemption under Roe, I think Roe stands for the possibility that the effect of these regulatory laws, and as we all know, common laws, regulatory law, if that's affecting the price, routes, and services of a broker, then it's preempted. So I don't think there is a scenario where you can find a tort law being applied to a shipper that would not be preempted by federal law. I don't think this court needs to revisit its decisions in Yee or Montgomery based upon what has already been pled or argued. The decisions in Yee in Montgomery look towards the totality of the preemption statute, and you have a federal regulatory scheme that protects brokers, in my case, a shipper, from these tort claims to regulate interstate commerce.
What's your position on waiting for the Supreme Court to see if it grants cert in Montgomery or Cox?
I don't think this court needs to wait on whether or not the Supreme Court grants cert, because from Cisco's position, our position is unique and it's not in those cases, Your Honor. So we would ask for a ruling on the issues. And if there's no further questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Mr. Tooney? You have a little bit of rebuttal time left.
Just a couple of comments, Your Honor. Section 14501 sub 1 sub c, the preemption clause, does not itself say brokers are to be preempted. It's left unsaid. So we think there's an actual issue here, as if the clause is susceptible to more than one plausible reading, courts generally, ordinarily, accept the reading that disfavors preemption. Second thing was that the second clause, 14501C2A, didn't list the word brokers in it. And that was something that the Yee case mentioned as thinking that this was intentional by Congress. But it also, that same statute did not include any of the other parties listed in the preemption clause. In other words, they left it open so that any person would have liability under that clause if the facts justified that.
Thank you, Mr. Toon.
So,
time's up. Thank you. Mr. L'Esperance?
Thank you, Your Honor. Use the time to respond to ACE's arguments, as my client is the only client that's in both appeals, two separate judgments. There was some arguments being made regarding, you know, there's no case law for the first person to write a demand to get the policy proceeds. There was also reference to, you know, second guessing fiduciary duties, and it's bad policy. This is a statutory right. This is a statutory right created by the Wisconsin Assembly. That's not for this court or the Wisconsin Supreme Court to modify. That is a decision made by the people of Wisconsin through their representatives. So that should not be modified on those grounds. Additionally, there's constant reference to four claimants, but the record is very clear that only one demand was made. The three other claimants never made a demand at any point in time. The court should not base its ruling on theoretical facts. This is not a case where four demands were made at the same time. This is not a case of four demands being made within 30 days of each other. Those are different circumstances and different facts. This is one claimant who made a demand who the insurer acknowledged was entitled to payment based on the facts provided in proof of claim, and yet the insurer did not pay. They can have any type of equitable distribution they want within that 30 days. They can try to resolve it with the four of them. But once that 30 days hits, payment is due. If it is not paid, then interest is made. Interest is compensable. It's not punitive. This is just like any other sort of common law right for interest, like in a contract case. That's all the Wisconsin Assembly's done here. And ACE made a choice. It wanted the release. And it wanted it really bad, and it wanted it from all four of them. And it chose to not pay the claim to hold out and get the settlement release. And under Wisconsin law and contents, which this case is held by, and the court correctly ruled upon, my client is entitled to interest on that because he made a proper demand. All those elements were satisfied. Subdivision two, there's constant reference about who is entitled to receive such payment. There's no reference to how much. Looking at the actual provision in subdivision two, it states who is entitled to payment. ACE knew who was entitled to payment, Tischhauser. Second of all, it knew who the other claimants were. All four of them were in the same vehicle. There's no dispute here. So to argue they didn't know who was entitled to the payment is baseless. They knew who it was. They just didn't want to make any specific determination on amounts. So unless the court has any questions, we just request that the court affirm the decision in the Tischhauser v. ACE matter and reverse the district court in the Tischhauser versus Mode versus Cisco. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The court will take the case under advisement. And we are going to take about a 10-minute break, and we'll pick up with case number three when we're back.
Thank you.